Hello, my name is Lisa Oliver King. I am with a grassroots organization based out of Grand Rapids, Michigan. We do a food justice project. I'm going to talk a little bit about that, but more so I'm going to focus on the relationships that we have built with academicians and researchers in the community around doing qualitative research. So we have no relationships to disclose. Okay. What am I doing here? Thank you. Who is OKT? So we're a grassroots, women's-led organization. We're focused on action that drives awareness around public policy and funding and social change. What makes us different than typical groups that we see working on food justice groups that we've looked at across the nation? Our work is driven by community-owned and managed research. I feel like my presentation has already been said by the presenters that have already been up here, because hopefully I will repeat some of the communications that you've already heard. So we looked at community-based participatory research. It did not fit what we were trying to do in the community. We wanted to make sure that our work was owned by the community, so we chose this particular model to use. We are a social justice group. We do not do urban agriculture. So across the nation, when we looked at food justice projects, they basically came in, let's show poor people how to grow food so they can eat healthy, and then they can sell food. We don't sell the notion of economics. You're going to come in, you're going to grow all this food, and then you're going to go to a farmer's market, and you're going to make $25,000 a year. That's just not reality. The other thing around that is that when we looked at food justice projects across the nation or food growing projects across the nation, folks grew food, and then when the summer was over, the garden went to weeds. So we were looking for something that would last, be sustainable in the community, and tied into what our focus is, which is around looking at public policy and public funding. We've mentioned popular education. The way that we came up with our project, which well, I think goes into our next slide, is about, you know, what are people already doing? We don't need to go into community and say, we're going to create this project and you're going to come join us. It don't work that way. People come out to what they're interested in. And what we found, people were already growing food. We didn't have to walk up in there and say, can we show you how to grow a tomato plant? We needed to walk in there and expand the experiences and the expertise that were already there in the community. We're a diverse group beyond race. We have those who are voters, non-voters. We have those who ride their bicycle, who catch the bus. It all makes a difference. So as the gentleman just said, we want to make sure that we're reaching various different type of people in the community at large. We look at asset, not deficit. Our project wasn't based on we have high rates of diabetes in the community. Our project was based on who's growing food, what do they know about food, and how does food make a difference in their life from a value perspective. And we have some very unique partnerships that I'll talk about. So our project is called the Food Diversity Project. Our goal is to create what we're calling a just, resident-owned, managed, and food demonstration learning lab for the purpose of creating access to fresh food. What the heck does that mean? That's a long title right there. So basically what we're trying to do is bring a neighborhood together for them to look at the issues, not around food, but the other systemic issues that they're dealing with, and how do they come together and not only address food, but they address water, they address land use, they address education. How do we do that? And that's all centered in one neighborhood. So if anybody went and heard like the opening session yesterday where they showed that fantastic commercial where, you know, you saw a neighborhood transition into a community park, that people would benefit from that, that's the vision that we have in terms of the work that we do. We have basically four objectives. We want to build capacity around food self-reliance, food security, food sovereignty. We want to create a curriculum that we can put out in the public domain so people can learn from what we were able to achieve and what were some of our weaknesses. We want to create a public policy campaign that's community-led based on the existing resources that already are there in the community. And we want to create common language and agreed-upon principle, bringing residents together to decide how are we going to do this work and what the sustainability or whatever the terminology that they use means the same to everyone. very good at this. So, what did we consider? We were unique in that we didn't decide to go into community and we're going to do this food justice project, like I said. We did an assessment before we determined what type of project we were going to do. I don't know if I mentioned this, but the Kellogg Foundation, who is currently funding us, approached us and invited us to do this grant. And we agreed to that under the condition that we had total control around how we were going to spend this money. So we were granted dollars for 3 years, and Kellogg agreed with us that in the last year, whatever was left in our budget, community would come together and they would manage what those dollars would be. So we looked at what were the community concerns, and food rose to the top. We looked at targeted neighborhoods. Where would we do this project? And so we labeled projects as hotspots and had legacy issues, so they had food insecurity issues as well as environmental health issues around that. We looked at health status of the family, not only epidemiological data, but what were people talking about in the community? I'm dealing with asthma. I'm dealing with diabetes. What are the public health issues that people were talking about, and how did it match up with our provider community? We also looked at what's the political climate. Michigan, like many states, has changed to a predominantly conservative Congress, and that Congress has pushed issues that have pushed more and more and more families into poverty. So we came up with an approach. Our approach, we do a container gardening project. We also do a neighborhood farmers market. We've been invited recently to do two schools, a school-based food sharing initiative, and our project is really driven by urban foraging. Mm-hmm. So what we found in a neighborhood, for example, like one neighborhood, folks were already growing tomatoes, and in fact, 21 different variety of tomatoes were growing in one neighborhood. But were folks tied into, how can I put it, into what other food that they could access? So we do a fruit and nut tree tour so that people know on public spaces there's food growing there. There is purslane. Does anybody know edible weeds? Okay, so we teach folks about edible weeds and that you're walking on food when you're going to the gas station. So of our container gardening project, we do a quilt approach, which is 85% of our container gardens are edible flowers and herbs, and then the rest are fruits and vegetables because we want people to come together and share food. We have typical partners, collaborative partners, that help us with our qualitative research, grassroots constituents, which make up our group, who do the majority of the work. We have created a community leadership circle, which is no different. It's basically an advisory group, but where it differs than our constituency group is in that they come together with certain resources that they can bring to the table. And then we have traditional partners, the Kent County Health Department. We have an African-American male dietitian. Can you believe it? A male dietitian? We were like, oh, my God, we got a male dietitian. And then we also deal with a group called the Food Policy. Why can't I get this? What I'm going to talk to you about today is the unique relationship that we have with an anthropologist. She is helping us to develop our curriculum as well as a public presence. So Dr. Nezzi, that's what we call her, helped us with various abstracts that we've presented, and we've been able to tell you guys about the work that we're doing. And then we have a wonderful guy. He's the guy down in the middle right there. His name is Dr. Clinton Boyd. He is a biochemist. So all of our food growers, they have their soil tested so that we can talk about the legacy issues that they're dealing with. Grand Rapids used to be farmland and fruit orchards, and so many of the land was contaminated by lead and arsenic because that was the common pesticide that they used. Okay. So, based on our relationship, we have determined what are some of the attributes that you need if you're going to go into partnerships with researchers and academicians, and then what are some of the challenges. So this slide tells you that when you're looking at attributes, you want to make sure that you can ensure a relationship that is mutually beneficial, like you've already heard up here. So, you know, that it's beneficial not only to your researcher that's coming in, but how is it beneficial also to the grassroots partner so that we are seen as the same. We use a community-owned and managed model. Our folks can hire and fire you. They dictate what you do. Before you can present any abstract, it has to be approved by community. But at the same time, they have access to the type of data that they need to collect that strengthens the research they're trying to do. Both parties are willing to learn from each other, and a great example of this with our biochemist. He was talking about different lead levels and, you know, the unit that you use for that, parts per million. What the heck does that mean when you see 10,000 parts per million? Well, a community constituent was able to say, think about it in terms of 5-pound bags of sugar. And so based on your number determines how many pounds of sugar that you have. And he was like, oh, I never thought about that. So he didn't look at like, oh, what do you know? He looked at, thanks for helping me to figure out how to illustrate the numbers that we're talking about. Avoid situations where either community becomes an extension of the researcher or we're looked at labor. 80% of the contacts that we have from researchers and community, they want us to go out and pass out flyers. They want us to go out and do their research. You know, they want us to go out and they want to pimp us to go out and do the legwork that they should be doing in community. But also what we find that happens in some of those dynamics is that community will take on the language of the researcher because they want to be seen as, I've learned from the scientists. So an example of that is that when some of our expert growers come in and they teach us about different type of plants and things like that, there was a big conversation of, do you call it soil or do you call it dirt? It's dirt. It grows. We know what that means. Don't start taking on the soil because the master gardener just came in and told you that. So establish rules around data use, presentations, and publications. Okay. And so some of the challenges that we have, I'll go through real quick, has been around language. I mean, we've had to teach our dietitian and our biochemist how do we come to a common language where everyone feels comfortable with what we're talking about. We've had to deal with our health department around issues around power dynamics. You know, it's like, okay, we want to sit and be at the table with you, but then when community begins to question them, it goes automatically into a power dynamic in which we got to check you and let you know we run this, not you. Dealing with distance, our anthropologist is in Boston, interpreting data and tangible deliverables. The reality is grants run out. Researchers are gone. What do you leave community? We don't want to be guilty of walking into community, doing the work that we do, and then we walk away, they're back in the same situation they were with before we came in. So we have some things that we would recommend that contributes to a successful partnership. It has to be led by community-led and people of color. It has to be grounded in values and principles. If your researcher doesn't think that everybody should have a basic right to water, you got a problem. Has to be incorporated in some sort of vetting system, strives to establish common language, and I left off a word there, and we have to create a win-win scenario. What is that community going to benefit from the fact that you, I don't know a nice way to say it, but you pimp this project off their conditions, and you get to walk away with data, research, and the availability to get access to more grants. So, what I wanted to leave you with that we've been very fortunate with the relationships that we've built with researchers. And they are now helping us to build case studies. We do more qualitative research than quantitative research. And so I'm running out of time here. If anybody wants to know more about these case studies, we can come back to that. And then here are a list of some of our other partners, non-traditional partners that are at the table. Thank you very much.